Hello and welcome to the show. Today we will be discussing about diabetes, the silent killer. Now most of us have heard of this or know somebody who's dealing with it. But do we really understand it? What are the early signs? How do we treat it? Or will there ever be a cure? To answer all of these questions, we have with us a very special guest who will help us throw more light on this. So Roshan, if you could please introduce our guest of the hour.
Hi Ashish, sure, it gives me great honor and such a pleasure to introduce Dr. Shalini Sridharan, who is a consultant endocrinologist at Pantai Hospital, Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Having trained in Malaysia and UK, she has been a practitioner for the last 17 years, who is extremely passionate about diabetes. Hi, Dr. Shalini, welcome to the show. Thank you for making time to be here with us today.
Hi, Roshan and Dr. Ashish. Thank you for having me here. And it's a pleasure to be part of this discussion.
Dr. Shalini, thank you so much for coming on the show. So we've been dealing with diabetes for a very, very long time. I think this is one of the oldest diseases which we have. And, you know, when we get into med school, everybody learns about it in general medicine. But the subject has evolved over the years to being more than just what we did during our MBBS, such that it has created a specialty of its own. And we now have endocrinologists who are treating patients. So if you give us a little bit of a history about diabetes and what it really is and who does it affect?
Right. You rightly said it's a very old disease. In fact, diabetes used to be treated actually by starvation before the discovery of insulin. So let me just give you a brief definition of diabetes. Diabetes is a chronic progressive disease actually characterized by elevated blood glucose level due to inadequate insulin level or inadequate of the body to respond to insulin. In short, we call it insulin resistance. So there are mainly two main types of diabetes, which is type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is basically a state of bankruptcy of insulin. There is no insulin level measured in the body, so the treatment is essentially giving insulin. Whereas type 2, which is the main bulk of the diabetes that we have in the world, about 90% is actually type 2, only about 10% or less is type 1, is characterized by a state of insulin resistance.
So if I understand this right, like there are two types of diabetes mainly, and type 1 is where insulin is not being produced by the body, and hence we can't break down the sugars which are there when we consume it. And in type 2, the receptors for the insulin are absent.
It wouldn't say receptors for the insulin are absent. It is a state of insulin resistance. So your body is not sensitive to the effect of insulin. Therefore, the glucose cannot come down the way it's supposed to be. And the response of the body towards a fat state is not appropriate. After food, usually you will have a bit of a spike, not very long, because the moment you eat, the insulin level will spike up and come down immediately when the food disappears. That regulation is absent or diminish in type 2 diabetes.
Dr. Shalini, then am I right to say as a normal, healthy individual, I should expect to have my blood glucose levels within a certain threshold, because the moment I eat, insulin is released, my body understands, hey, insulin is released, let's start breaking things down, and therefore keeping my blood sugar level at a certain threshold. Could you maybe explain to us, what would I have to observe for as a lay person when it comes to understanding if I'm even resistant to the insulin that's being produced by my body? Could you sort of break it down for us maybe?
Right, so for acceptable or normal range of glucose level of the blood, we have glucose level in a pre-fat state and post-meal state. So basically, if you had an overnight fast, that means you just got up, there's no food for the past 8 hours, your fasting state would be at a level of 4.5 to maximum 7, all right? So after meal, usually the glucose should not exceed more than 7.8 after 2 hours after meal. So anything that is above this level would categorize you as a pre-diabetes, or if it's fulfilling the diagnosis of diabetes, then we would define that individual to have the disease. So how do we define it? If you have a fasting blood glucose level of more than 7 or a random blood glucose of more than 11.1 with or without symptoms of hyperglycemia. So what are the symptoms of hyperglycemia? That means passing out a lot of urine, frequently feeling thirsty, loss of weight, increased need for food, and especially increased need for sugary food and drinks. That are the symptoms of diabetes. So whereas the symptoms are usually quite common only when the glucose level is extremely high, the vast majority of patients actually are not aware that they have the disease until they do a medical blood screening.
Well, I think that's a very good point which you made over there, which is like the majority of people don't really know that they are having these symptoms. You mentioned increased urination or polyuria, thirst. But you also mentioned the desire for more sugar. Really, is that true?
Yeah, okay. So not many people are aware. These are also symptoms to suggest high blood glucose level, because the glucose is actually staying in the blood and not received by the cells in the body. That is usually the ones that need to absorb in the glucose to turn it into energy. So your muscles need the glucose for it to contract and move. And of course, the other cells in the body needs glucose. Your brain needs glucose. Your heart needs glucose. So these organs are actually unable to utilize this glucose that is confined to the blood. So that is why we are trying to get the individual to be more sensitive to insulin, so that insulin are the main drivers to the utilization of glucose that is there in the blood. So when the body perceives like there's not enough of sugar, the drive is to eat more sugar and also consume more carbs. Yeah, they usually wouldn't go and reach out for a vegetable or protein. You see, they will go for the refined sugars and cakes or anything sweet that gives the glucose rush, and that essentially comes from carbohydrates.
Dr. Charlene, may I just sort of check in here? But are there other lesser known symptoms that are slowly cropping up based on your observation as the demography of type 2 diabetics are shifting in today's world, especially the age groups, the newer symptoms? What are your observations, Dr. Charlene?
Right, let me just go through the other common manifestations of diabetes. So some of the patients actually wouldn't, as I mentioned, are not aware that they have elevated blood glucose level. So sometimes the first presentation to the hospital or to the doctor is with complications of high glucose level, which essentially are things like infections that keep recurring. Like for females, is vaginal thrush, vaginal candidiasis, urinary tract infection, or some even actually comes in with a very poor healing ulcers in the food, or even some actually comes in with diabetes emergency where the glucose level is extremely high. They go in a state of high acid levels, of severely dehydrated as the first presentation. Other presentations of diabetes, actually patient coming in with a sudden heart attack or a stroke, a blurring of vision. So these are some of the other symptoms of diabetes that usually patient bring themselves about to the doctors.
But another thing which interests me, I think Roshan was hitting on that, which is where earlier on we used to find that it was more in the late 40s, 50s and the elderlies who were mainly affected by diabetes. But, and I'm not talking about like juvenile diabetes, I'm talking about, you know, the young adults like, you know, 30 and 35 who are now turning diabetic. In today's world, we're finding that. And maybe if you could throw some light on what the cause is and, you know, why this is happening.
As you correctly mentioned, diabetes, okay, here we are talking about type 2 diabetes because this is the vast majority of diabetes, used to be known as adult onset diabetes, okay? So in other words, it used to be a disease of the middle age and above. But what we are seeing, there is a rapid shift of the young onset diabetes. So young being anyone less than 40. So it can range adolescence to 40, and we call it young type 2 diabetes, okay? We no longer call it adult onset diabetes. It's just, if it's less than 40, we call it young type 2 diabetes. If it's beyond 40, then it's just diabetes. So the reasons behind why we're seeing younger individuals developing this disease, I would say vast majority is the fact that we are shifting towards urbanization. So the food that we take has high amount of calorie instead of nutrient, right? So these are the things that we are not aware of, that we are consuming too much for lesser utilization of this energy than we take in. So what happens when there is too much energy intake but not much spent? It develops a state of overweight and obesity. So obesity actually contributes to about as much of 80% risk of type 2 diabetes. And in fact, for, I do not know about India, but Malaysia, it has become the fattest country for Southeast Asia, as much as 50% of our population is actually overweight and obese. So that alone has brought the numbers of type 2 diabetes exponentially increased through the years. It used to be 1 in 11 once upon a time, but the prevalence now in Malaysia is about 1 in 5. So every 5% probably there is one suffering with diabetes. In the younger adults, so we are talking about 18 to 30, that's about 5%. That means these are the age where they're in the college or university or starting off their career and they are developing the disease. The problem of developing the disease at a young age is that the complications will definitely set in after 5 years. And what happens when complications sets in and worsens is that the lifespan of that individual is reduced. And the reduction of the lifespan can be as much as 5 to 10 years. If you develop complications like heart disease, kidney disease, even stroke. So we have cases where young individuals who are at the 30s or 40s coming in with stroke or kidney failure. And some actually have diabetic retinopathy, which can lead to blindness. So I have a case where, if I would just share with you a story. So I've worked both in the rural area of Malaysia and also the urban area. So when I was in a rural area, what struck me the most of how detrimental the complications of diabetes is when I saw young lady actually in her 30s, groping her way into my room. And then behind her was her 5-year-old daughter. Can you imagine that the 5-year-old daughter is helping the mother into the consultation room at this tender age? She's supposed to be her mother's helper because the mother can't see well. So that is how serious the complication and how early the complications can come. And for people who have diabetes at a young age, the complication seems to be more aggressive and also harder to treat. Aggressive meaning the progression, you know, from just a mild diabetic retinopathy, the progression to worsening of the eye condition and also the kidney condition seems to be more rapid. And we have individuals in the 30s and 40s who are spending their time in a dialysis center because of this end-stage renal failure development.
Now, Dr. Shalini, you talked about obesity being one of the biggest risk factors and now affecting our youngsters. But are there other risk factors which are there?
So we have the modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. So if you look at non-modifiable, so being genetically inherited, so if there is a family history of diabetes, that puts an individual at higher risk. And even more so if the individual mother, while carrying the child, has diabetes, or we call it gestational diabetes, the chances of the baby developing diabetes when he or she is born in adulthood is higher. So these are more commonly seen. Probably we are diagnosing it more these days compared to previously. You know, diabetes in pregnancy is as common as 10% of all pregnant ladies in Malaysia. I'm sure amount of prevalence in India is also similar or even more. The offsprings are increasing chance of developing the disease. And then, of course, I've mentioned sedentary. When we are more urbanized, there's lesser need for, you know, doing a lot of hard work. So all these things have made not only obesity, but risk of diabetes increasing. Of course, stress is another risk factor that people don't really pay attention to. Stress, everybody is stressed, especially in the pandemic. We are not only physically stressed, sometimes emotionally and mentally stressed. And not knowing that stress also drives your blood glucose higher. And some people cope with stress by eating more. And that's probably some of the risk factors. Of course, smoking, lack of exercise, of dietary habits. Being Asians, our food is heavily
carbohydrate-driven.
Yeah, carbohydrate, yes.
Dr. Shalini, you know, you brought up a very interesting point about the moving age group where we're having younger diabetics and that it is leading to us having more aggressive disease progression. On that note, I would like to sort of use this as a segue to speak about something a little, I would say, controversial or a little less looked at. Let's talk about the people who are below 40. Young moms, young dads. I'm sure besides diabetic retinopathy, you know, neuropathies, kidney issues, you're having issues with quality of life, specifically when you look at their marital life, libido, loss of libido, impotence. You have very low sex drives. And it's a very long tail sort of presentation. Maybe could you make us understand what we are missing out on, really? I guess there's a lot of frustration, and these are questions we don't ask our doctors in the consultation room. There's a lot of fear of judgment, stigma maybe. Could you make us understand a little bit more?
Right, okay. So let me just elaborate a little bit more of some other less known complications of diabetes. Actually, we have a term called diabetes distress amount of patients, and about 36% of our patients actually admitted having this definition of diabetes distress. Basically, they are just distressed, or they find it very troublesome dealing with the disease and they can't cope. About 15% of them actually are suffering from depression due to the fact that they are diabetic. All right, so diabetes distress and depression is, of course, a factor of a decrease of quality of life. And you've rightly mentioned so that with diabetes also, not only the fact that they have low libido, they have low energy level. When you don't have energy, you can't have the desire to be the youthfulness of a man or a lady diminishes as well. If you're supposed to be young, but you have libido of an old man, that's also not good. And impotence, or we also call it erectile dysfunction, is also more common among patients with diabetes. As much as 35 to 45% of our patients actually have erectile dysfunction. And out of this, how many get diagnosed? As you've rightly mentioned, they are very shy about it. They are not open about it because they fear it's being judged as being less man. They don't talk about it because, you know, being Asians, we don't openly discuss about our sexual stories and our sexual health problems.
That's usually doesn't exist for most Asians.
Yeah. And of course, the doctors are also shy. If you ask me, I'm a female doctor. And if my patient is a male, it's just trying to open up about it. It takes some amount of effort, and we have to be really open, and we don't want to offend our patients. Not all patients are happy to discuss about it, you know, and probably they say, I didn't even ask you, why are you asking me? So there are, you know, we have different types of patients, and some may be offended. So we don't want to offend our patient, but yes, we agree that it is underdiagnosed and undertreated condition. I just want to mention having impotence and erectile dysfunction can be the first sign or symptoms of diabetes, and is also a risk factor of coronary artery disease, because impotence is actually basically a diminished flow of blood to the genitalia during sexual intercourse. You can't get an adequate erection for sexual penetration. So what happens is that it's probably a condition of atherosclerosis. So that causes erectile dysfunction. And if you have diminished flow to the penis, you can have diminished flow even to the heart. So that is one of the reasons if we find a patient with impotence or erectile dysfunction, we usually ask or even screen for potentially undiagnosed ischemic heart disease.
And these are things which, you know, we really don't hear so often about. Thank you so much, Dr. Shalini, for throwing light on it. On that note, let's take a break, guys, and we'll be back after the break.
Is your diet killing you? Are stem cells the future? Am I just one medical bill away from bankruptcy? Demystify these questions and more with Dr. Viroshini and Dr. Ashish as they navigate the frontiers of medical science while breaking the barriers between the patient and the medical fraternity. Tune into Beyond the Diagnosis, not your typical medical podcast. Every fortnight on your favorite podcast network. A Pandemia Inc. production.
Welcome back to Beyond the Diagnosis, not your typical medical podcast. With us, we have Dr. Shalini. We left off at the point where we spoke about atypical, lesser known symptoms. Dr. Shalini, please walk us through what we would have missed out as complications that are then related to all of these manifestations. I'm sure there's a laundry list. We would really like to know what we could actually do for these things and what we should be watching out for.
Right. So the part of treating or managing patients with diabetes is actually to look out for the target organ damage. So target organ damage, we can broadly classify into microvascular being damage to the small vessels, micro being small, vascular being vessels, and also macrovascular, which is the big vessels of the body. All right. So where are these small vessels located? in the eyes, nerves, and also in the kidneys. So these small blood vessels actually supplies to the glomerular, which is the filtering system of our body, which is located in the kidney. And the macrovascular is blood vessels that supplies the vital organs such as the heart, the brain, and also to the lower limb. So the microvascular complications being kidney usually can easily be screened by doing a urine analysis for any leakage of protein. Right, that's probably the first sign of kidney complications of diabetes. Other than that, as for the eyes, you have to do eye screening where we actually send the patient for a fundus camera or a funduscopy examination to look at the eye vessels and to see any small bleed or maybe what we call background retinopathy. These are the ways we diagnose patients to have target organ damage. Even when the patients do not suffer from the complications yet, we are already detecting it and addressing it with medications. And also, ultimately, the treatment is to get the glucose level as normal as possible. So because the complications does tend to go higher or worsen if the dysglycemia or high glucose level is not addressed. Other things like screening for more vital organ complications is like doing a stress test to look for possible undiagnosed ischemic heart disease, and also for the lower limbs. This is another organs that are usually ignored. Many of our patients actually have diminished blood flow to the lower limbs that also contributes to low or diminished ability for wound to heal. So a non-healing or slow healing ulcers of the feet actually can be due to the vasculature, or we call it peripheral vascular disease, which usually can be diagnosed by either just palpating for the pulses and looking at the color of the feet and look at how the skin are. You can actually pick up the possible diminished blood flow to the feet and lower limb. Some patients actually present with claudication pain or pain while walking long distance. So that's another symptoms that we look out for. For the nerve neuropathy, it's not only just about peripheral neuropathy. We have autonomic neuropathy, which also contributes to impotence or erectile dysfunction. It also can cause gastroparesis, a state where some patients actually have reflux symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea. It's just because of the autonomic dysregulation in the gastrointestinal system.
Can be tied to this too? Oh, wow.
Yes, yes.
Well, because I think most patients, I mean, they'll always be looking at it very separately as, you know, oh, I've got like a gastro reflux problem, but I'm not putting two and two together, you know, probably they're suffering from diabetes for a very long time and it could be both involved.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Shalini, this is a question that comes from a place of fear, if I may. As a layperson, actually no, as a former practitioner, but now thinking as a layperson, am I right to say that the moment we go beyond a certain level, nothing is reversible? Is it that scary? Is diabetes that scary?
Right. So when we are talking about reversibility, there is a point in time where there is nothing that we can do except to treat the complications. If your kidney, we call it diabetes nephropathy or kidney impairment due to diabetes, and we have 5 stages of it. So if the patient reaches the 5th stage, which the only treatment that can be offered is actually dialysis. You cannot turn end-stage renal failure back to the pre-failure once they reach that stage. And the treatment is actually to refer the patient to a nephrologist and they prepare the patient for some form of renal replacement, whether it's hemodialysis, peritoneal dialysis, or even kidney transplant. So that is a point of no return in terms of complications to the kidney. But despite the fact that a lot of our patients who have end-stage renal failure, they are still diabetic. So there are other things that, you know, haven't been completely damaged, especially the heart. Coronary heart disease increases even more. So these are the things that we start to address. So if you look at the trajectory of diabetes medications, we are no longer focusing on just lowering down the glucose. We are looking at kidney protection, heart protection. So the newer agents nowadays have kidney protection's ability, heart protection ability, and also reduction in the incidence of symptomatic heart failure and also a worsening of progression of heart failure. So that has changed over the past one decade, I would say. And now we have agents that actually addresses the risk factor of diabetes, which is, as I mentioned, increasing obesity, weight, and also even visceral obesity, that not only gives rise to diabetes, but also fatty liver disease, which is also a very common manifestation of metabolic disorders. So these are the things that the newer medications are addressing, not only to lower the glucose level, but to reduce the patient's weight. Because when you reduce the weight, generally, the fat in the liver, we call it the fatty liver, also reduces. And in fact, fatty liver is usually treated most effectively by weight loss.
Dr. Shalini, that's very, very enlightening. I never knew that we're having agents today or medications today that are more holistic than they were a decade ago. This hits very, very close to those who have reached a level where reversibility is an issue. So we go towards cardioprotective, nephroprotective trajectories. What about young diabetics who have just gotten diagnosed? Do they have a grace period or a free look period where there is some element of reversibility that can come in? Asking for a friend.
Yeah, so basically, we call it the newer onset of diabetes. Yeah, many of our patients who have just got the diagnosis said, "Doctor, can this be reversed? Can I do something to turn things around?" We call it getting it into remission. As I mentioned earlier, diabetes is a chronic progressive disease. So if the moment you have the diagnosis, about 50% of your pancreatic function is already diminished. Now you're trying to gain back that 50% that is lost. How are you going to help this pancreas of yours to recover? Essentially is to reduce the burden to the pancreas. How? Dietary intervention. Dietary intervention, that means go on a lower calorie diet consumption. That means we are looking at somewhere between 1,200 to 1,500 kilocalories for females and the most 1,800 for males. But what we are doing now, actually many of our patients not realizing they're actually consuming about 3,000 kilocals per day. So if you get it to become 500 to 1,000 kilocalories lower consumption per day, that would also help get your diabetes into remission. We don't call it a reverse, we call it remission. So some patients with 5 to 10% of weight loss can get themselves from diabetes to a pre-diabetes state. That means the glucose level, the HbA1c, which is a marker of the glycemic control, improve from a diabetic range to a pre-diabetes. And if you're in pre-diabetes, you can get yourself a normal non-diabetic range with diet exercise. And diet exercise, effective diet exercise, is usually translated with a weight loss. That means reduction in fat mass. And not forgetting, when you are dieting, you're supposed to build muscle. We do not want you to lose fat and muscle. We want you to gain muscle but lose the fat. So because skeletal muscles are a great utilizer of glucose. So that's one of the importance of muscle building when you're trying to lose weight.
Yes, so the common practice is to build your protein up in your meal and reduce your carbs, basically. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have the recommended composition of percentage. You're still supposed to eat carbohydrates. So there are people that is going on ketogenic diet and all kinds of diet which really diminish their carbohydrate intake. Us and the fraternity of diabetes do not agree that you should, you know, go of total zero or minimal carbohydrate. But what we are suggesting is reduction in carbohydrate intake, rather than totally no carbohydrate. Because if you go totally carbohydrate free, you will have other complications that, you know, people go on high fat, high protein that, you know, can also trigger ischemic heart disease development. When you're consuming a lot of meat that is, you know, protein rich, it has some drawbacks and it can give rise to problems. Keto acid starts to form and it might not be safe for everybody, though it has the advantage and ability for weight loss.
Yeah, but I think that is one of the most debated things nowadays, which is the conversation about higher protein compared to carbohydrates. And then there is that school of thought which now says that carbohydrates is not essential and, you know, you should go towards more protein and skip your carbohydrates. But your advice is moderation, basically. Yeah. And everything in moderation is always healthier.
Yes, just cutting the carbohydrate by 50% of what you are taking now. Because as I mentioned earlier, Asians, 90% are carbohydrate. You get it only to 50%, that's already helping your glycemic parameters.
At this point, I want to clarify this. I've heard this before, which is, you know, fruits, it's fructose. It's an alternative source to glucose. And so if you're a fruitarian, will you be diabetic then?
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting question. So a lot of people say it's good, fruits are good, obviously, because of the nutrients that it brings about, it's good. But of course, sweet fruits are going to give rise to high glucose level, especially ripe. Papayas, bananas, watermelon is high glycemic index of glucose inside. There's basically not much of fiber. So that is going to give rise to high glucose. And if you're just taking fruits, I mean, you're probably depriving yourself of a lot of other macronutrients that your body needs. So taking fruits is good, but obviously you need other food pyramid that you...
Dr. Shalini, Ashish, can I go a little off tangent here?
So,
if I were to study, if I were to study Steve Jobs, who was completely fruitarian for some time and who had pancreatic cancer, what happened there? Like, how do you tie it back to diabetes? Is that precisely it, Dr. Shalini? We do not want to send our pancreas into overdrive.
Right. Actually, his pancreatic cancer was a neuroendocrine tumor. So, which is actually different from diabetes kind of complication, because it's just a tumor that not related to diabetes, actually. So, he had life-threatening terminal kind of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor. I mean, I don't know Steve Jobs as well as you do, but yeah, but we never tell our patients be a fruitarian or vegetarian as a way to prevent diabetes, as that's for sure.
Another very, very famous thing which is going on right now to beat diabetes again is intermittent fasting.
Right.
What about intermittent fasting?
Right. Intermittent fasting is a time restriction eating. That means they only restrict eating to a certain hours of the day. That means maybe four to 8 hours time frame. So they get into a state of fasting. So when in the fasting state, what happens is that there's not much of calories to burn because there's no food. So that's when the fats get burned and, you know, they manage to lose some weight with that. And indirectly, that would also help their diabetes. But what we are seeing is, from the evidence, is that intermittent fasting versus lower calorie diet, there's not much of difference in terms of the ability for weight loss and improvement of type 2 diabetes. So we, despite the fact that many have seen success in weight loss with intermittent fasting, in terms of overall benefit, it's not much difference with calorie restriction, which is the normal diet that we advocate for our patients.
Monitoring what goes in and what comes out. Yeah. Keeping an even balance. Yeah. So Dr. Shalini, we were talking about, you know, lifestyle modification, right? Like, you know, losing weight, keeping healthy, and trying to keep diabetes at bay. But for those who are unable to do that, now we come into the field of allopathic medication. So where does that come into
play? Right. Nowadays, we advocate combination treatment where we use non-pharmacological approach combination with pharmacology. How it helps is that when you ask the patient to go on a diet and exercise, you ask the patient to lose weight, it's easier said than done. Many of them struggle to shed the extra weight. So nowadays, what we are trying to introduce is the utilization of medications that treats diabetes and also reduce weight. So I'd just like to mention a few of these agents that is already there in the market, which initially started with as a use for treatment of diabetes and now being used even for treatment for obesity. So in terms of pharmacological treatment, if we look at the patient as a whole and the patient is overweight and or getting fatter with the utilization of insulin or the traditional old medications that we use to treat diabetes, now we are moving away from weight gain medications, we are going towards weight loss medication. So using these agents in combination with diet exercise does help the patient to achieve better results compared to just giving them a minimal amount of help with medications, but forcing them to, you know, change their lifestyle. So the lifestyle intervention among Asians actually is not very successful, I would say. Asians, if you look compared to our Western counterparts, their success rate with intensive lifestyle seems to do better versus Asian. There are many factors. Of course, our situation and conditions may not make exercise actually a very attractive thing for most of us. I would say that maybe the humid, hot weather is not feasible, you know, things like this. So, but now we are trying, I think it's getting more popular. Exercise, gyms and all are quite trendy these days. We have a lot more youngsters going to the gym, trying to stay fit, trying to get better looking bodies. All these are something that we encourage. But obviously, if we are doing all the exercise but not looking after diet, of course, it's not helpful. So, of course, and sometimes when you eat, you tend to overeat. So, some of the medications that we are introducing these days have some effect to the appetite and the feeling of fullness. Right, so that we also are advocating treating pre-diabetes rather than waiting for them to go into the diagnosis of diabetes before intervening for them. So now we are moving towards preventive medication rather than treating patients who already have diabetes and its complications. So we are moving towards diabetologists and endocrinologists' role is actually treating the risk factors rather than the complications. So usually when complication sets in, that is when we send them to a cardiologist, nephrologist, we even have to send them to neurologists and gastroenterologists for all the complications that type 2 diabetes we bring.
Can I just sort of disturb you there for a second? Dr. Shalini, you left us with some very important things to think about. Moving on to more holistic medication, making sure pharmacotherapy is a lot more inclusive. I am sure we've got listeners today who are listening to this particular podcast, hoping to have a little bit more light being they themselves being diabetics. Could you maybe give us a little bit more light or shed a little bit more light around why do we gain weight on insulin and why is it important for us to shift? Even if my blood sugar levels are very well controlled, my HbA1c is very well controlled, why should I shift and why does insulin make me gain weight?
Right. Okay. Insulin is a good friend for diabetes patient. Actually, it's not an enemy, but it has its side effects or downside of it because insulin actually turns this glucose into energy or is stored as fat. That's insulin. It's an anabolic hormone. It is hormone that builds up. So individuals with have high insulin levels usually tend to have more fat accumulation. But it helps brings down the glucose level in the blood. So what we are aiming is that we're trying to for type 2 diabetes to avoid the need for being on insulin. So how to improve patients' insulin sensitivity is actually, yes, one of the way is lose the fat. The more fat you gain, the more resistant. The other one is to build more muscles. Okay. So if you require insulin, that's probably a good thing also because not all insulin is going to be harmful for you. Sometimes there is a point where you need insulin as a first-line treatment because when the sugar is in the 20s and you're peeing a lot and you're losing weight, the way to reverse all the symptoms effectively is actually to give insulin. But once your pancreas has recovered a little bit from the state of glucotoxicity, where the glucose is too high, which is also toxic to the pancreatic cells, what you can do is actually to withdraw or reduce the dose of insulin, use more oral medications that helps with insulin resistance or even stimulates the production of insulin by the pancreas. That's the way forward for type 2 diabetes. But having said that, after being 10 years down the line with the disease, there may come a time when insulin becomes mandatory. But we have agents now that can probably be as effective as insulin in terms of getting the glucose down, but doesn't cause weight gain that insulin usually brings. So examples of these new agents are GLP-1 receptor agonists, okay? Glucagon-like peptide receptor agonists. It's a natural hormone that is also in our body, but much diminished. That's how insulin levels are diminished in a diabetic. This GLP-1 is also diminished. So we give GLP-1, helps with the reduction of glucose level without the risk of developing hypoglycemia and without the side effect of weight gain that insulin brings. In fact, GLP-1s reduces weight and patients develop weight loss. So we are moving towards getting patients as quick as we can to insulin, but trying to get them away from it by addressing the other factors that is more pronounced in type 2 diabetes. Yeah,
I think, Dr. Shalini, another thing that crops up with diabetes is it's such a long-standing disease that when you get onto medication quite early, we develop a certain resistance to the medicine also, or it just is not as effective down the line. If you can throw light on that, that would be great.
Right. So if you look at patients who are not insulin resistant but insulin deficient, like the type 1 diabetes patients, they're usually very lean and small, and they're very responsive to the insulin that they receive. So over time, there is a possibility that resistance builds up, you know, like any other conditions, that the medications fail to work as effectively as it used to be. So what are we doing to overcome it is that we address why is the body now resistant. And so when we address is if it's patients eating too much, so when there's a lot of glucose, then obviously resistance builds up, you know, body is no longer able to utilize the insulin that is there in the body. So what are we going to give to help patients improve back this sensitivity towards insulin? And one of the way to actually improve insulin sensitivity back or reduces the resistance is actually to get the patient to lose the weight. All right, the moment the weight goes down, the sensitivity improves. And, you know, the medications that we are giving is also to help the body, to help the muscles to be more sensitive to insulin, uses the glucose so that it can be turned into energy. And obviously, any medications that can help with weight loss is also can be combined as a treatment armamentarium for type 2 diabetes. So it's being holistic. You know, we're not just trying to lower the glucose, we're trying to reduce the fat gain, we're trying to reduce the complications. So it's just all the pieces of the puzzles that we need to bring in to help to create a better picture and outcome for the patient.
So, Doc, we're talking about allopathic medication, but what about Ayurvedic? I come from a land of Ayurveda, and it's used here, at least in the early stages of diabetes. A lot of people go and believe in it. I mean, I don't know the sciences of it, and I don't like discrediting anything I don't know of. But do you have any knowledge about it, or do you use it in association with your practice or anything like that?
Unfortunately, I'm exactly like you. I have no knowledge of Ayurvedic, and I'm sure there have been some success stories with Ayurvedic for some other medical conditions, but I have seen patients relying on Ayurvedic and failing that, comes back to us, get treated with modern medicines, and then they find themselves, you know, oh, actually, you know, I should have just been on modern medicine rather than trying on Ayurvedic. Because essentially the treatment of type 2 diabetes or type 1 diabetes is very straightforward. It's not a disease that is new. It's been there for ages, centuries. And we have known more and more. You know, last time when we first learned about diabetes, it's only about insulin deficiency and insulin resistance. Now we know that it's even the gut conditions, you know, lack of the inhibition of satiety, hunger issues, things like glucose is being reabsorbed much more from the kidney in diabetes patient, and also the fats are the main reasons why people are insulin resistant, and things like that are being addressed. So the treatment is, you don't have to find Ayurvedic to get treated. You know, because for modern medicine, we have a definite evidence-based effective medications that is on board. And being effective also, we also go into assessing the safety. In 2008, there was a medication called Avandia that has now been, you know, less popular because they found this medication triggering a lot of episodes of heart failures and even death. So since then, right, for any new diabetic medication to be allowed to be used in the US, they have to go into a trial, we call it cardiovascular outcome trial, to assess the cardiovascular safety of this medication. So to prove within the 3 or 5 years of using this medication, there's not any untoward complications that the patient will get, which usually will be picked up within that time frame. So it is safe. So if it's safe, why would you try something out there that is, you know, not evidence-based or maybe lack of evidence, which is just observational or anecdotal, some success stories here and there? That's my take of it.
Very commonly we do hear, you know, when patients are on Ayurvedic medication or homeopathic medication, it always comes with the clause that you need to lose weight. So if the medication or the Ayurvedic medication which is given to you is not working, it's generally because you have not lost the weight. And we know very well in diabetes that if you do lose the weight, you're automatically reversing the process. So yeah, like I said, I don't know too much about it, and so I wouldn't want to be the one who talks about it. I probably will get somebody from that area of expertise, and then, you know, we could have a conversation with them. Doc, so before I let you go, I have to ask you this question. What's the future? Is there ever going to be a pill which will cure diabetes? Is there something like that?
Yeah, I think we are moving towards that. But being an endocrinologist, like I've mentioned before, we want to do preventive or risk treatment control rather than, you know, treating the once the disease has come. So what is out there is that, you know, we have better insulin. So better insulin, by definition, is something that doesn't give you so much of weight gain and also doesn't reduces your glucose too much, a point of too low, which is dangerous. So we are improving in terms of the quality of insulins that we have now. The other one is that we are moving towards medications that causes either no increase of weight or more reduction of weight if you use them, rather than the conventional, where most of them causes weight gain. We are also moving towards a once daily and combination therapy rather than giving stepwise approach. So previously, the way we treat diabetes is that once a patient comes, no matter how high the glucose, we start with one medication first. And then after 3 months, we add on a second medication. That is the traditional way. So now we are using combination. We can even use 3 or 4 medications at a point of diagnosis to get the glucose down to as normal as possible. And then once their patients recover the control of glucose by their own body, then that's when we remove some of the medication. And then when your diets and exercise kicks in, then the medication amount can be reduced, insulin doses can be reduced. So that is the way we are trying to move or helping the patients to see that, you know, you don't always need so much of medications for the next 10 years of your life. We can improve it with early utilization of combination therapy. Right, because the pathways in diabetes, what causes diabetes, there are now more than 2 that we used to learn in our medical school. There are already 8. Some are now saying there's 12 pathways that we need to address. So there are many more pharmacotherapies that can be used in future to address diabetes and might be more safer than what we have now.
Superb. Thank you so much, Dr. Shalini. I mean, I think you have covered the whole thing holistically as possible within the time frame. And I hope our audience could try and get enough information which would help them, guide them through their journey through diabetes or help somebody who they know. Thank you once again. Thank you, Roshan, for, you know, being my amazing co-host on this show. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, please do subscribe. This is a new show and we're hoping you leave your notes and comments underneath. Do follow us on our handle on Twitter, Instagram. Do follow Dr. Shalini. Her link in bio will be given in our show notes. And until the next time, please do continue to subscribe and follow. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Roshan. And thank you, Dr. Ashish, for this session. I truly enjoyed myself.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Shalini. Thank you, Ashish, for being an amazing host with me. And on that note, we will be back with more interesting information. Maybe, Dr. Shalini, to your point, we can have you on the show again to talk about digital therapeutics, Internet of Things, and how this has evolved with regards to chronic progressive illnesses. So thank you very much, everyone, and have a pleasant evening.
Bye.